So hi, everybody, and welcome to our content implementation call. I know that some of you are at different places in the program, but these, I've been given the feedback that these are very helpful wherever you are in the program because it lets you get excited about what's yet to come. So today we're going to be working on finishing up the fatty acid testing and really finishing up the immune testing. So I think what we did last time was immune system testing, and we started on fatty acids, and then there's a whole module on fatty acid testing and another whole module on allergy testing. So my goal for today is to get through those and give you some good insights on, you know, where to go when you get presented with a blood spot fatty acid test, because they're actually one of the easiest tests to read when you know what you're looking for. So I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. And here we are, fatty acid testing. So we're going to start with fatty acid testing. I'll start with the learning objectives, and I'd just like to review these so everybody has a sense of what to expect. And my computer completely died this morning, so hopefully it stays. So here are some of the objectives. We want you to understand how the person's presenting complaints and indicate that they might have a fatty acid imbalance so that you can pinpoint areas of imbalance to be corrected via taking the test. Understanding the inflammatory cascade. We've introduced this in so many places, and you're going to get that this is an important thing that you really study and really understand. We first introduced it in the fats part of the macronutrients. We introduced it in the immune system testing. We'll go back over it in the detox module. So it's so important and so critical to your understanding of how things are working and where people are breaking down, but also in explaining to people. And I find that when you really understand the inflammatory cascade and you can peel out the pictures and start explaining to people, they get it and they actually start to take action much more than if you just say, oh, you need omega-3 fats. Oh, balance your omega-6s and 3. Here's what to eat. They don't get it for very long, but when you show them the picture and you show them how it's related to their joint pain, their stomach pain, their whatever inflammation they have, they really get it. Know how to assess the fatty acid status via the different types of fatty acid. There's a blood spot, there's the full blood, and then there's red blood cells. So we generally do the simple one, blood spot. That's the one I do the most often. Every now and then I go further because I don't get enough information from there, and I suspect something a little bit more esoteric. And I'll do a full blood, which tests a lot more of the fatty acids. And then I don't know that the erythrocyte one, I think, is where they're just testing the red blood cells for their fatty acid test. And I don't think I've ever done one of those. I don't think there's a need for it. It's either the blood spot, which is the least expensive, easiest to do, and they just prick their fingers, send the card in and get it, or full blood, where they have to get their blood drawn, and then you get more information. I want you to be able to, look at what are the physical exam signs of fatty acid deficiency so you can monitor for improvement without having to redo the tests over and over. And there are some general signs, and we'll go over some of those. Be familiar with our tracking spreadsheet for the omega-3-6 ratios. And that's a really helpful way to guide people into eating, you know, less of certain foods and more of other foods, as opposed to they just randomly go, oh, I'm just going to eat pumpkin seeds, or I'm just going to eat, you know, flax seeds or whatever. And they don't really look at the ratios. When they start to think in terms of the ratios and you can guide them there, you're going to get better compliance, but also better results. People can have such amazingly quick responses when they get their fatty acids in balance. Know what lab tests are appropriate and how to order them. And I'll show you that. Understand how to interpret various blood spot markers. So it's just so critical going through these markers, and you can actually start telling people, oh, I think you're not getting enough B vitamins, or you're probably eating a bunch of chia seeds because your number is here high, but you don't have enough of the nutrients to convert. And they're so easy and fun to explain. People get it. It's really, really helpful. We do hundreds of these every year. And then, understand the nutritional modulation chart, and we'll go through that. We've gone through this before in other modules, and I just want to keep like hammering it in. I went over this during our recent Shine Online event, and people just really saw things in a different way. And then I'm going to show you some case studies and how to recognize similar patterns in your own clients. And we do have a pretest. It's like usual. They're 5 to 10 questions long, just to have you get a sense. It's not really for us, but it's really for you to get a sense of how much you already know going into it and where you need to focus your attention once you're there. So yeah, 10 questions. And then let's look at the core content.
Are you wanting to share your screen?
Oh, I was. I hit share screen. Oh, Lordy. Thank you for letting me know that, Lynn.
I just got here and you were talking like, oh, she's sharing something. I'm not seeing
it. And nobody's seeing it. So I just basically went through the learning objectives and the pretest. The core content is where I'm going to go. And that's where the meat of it is, right?
You can well, that explains it. I walked in, when I came in, you were already talking. I was like, oh, I thought she was just talking.
Sorry about that. Now you see it, right? So we're going over fatty acid testing today. And we're also going to go over allergy testing. We started on fatty acid testing because it was the tail end of the assessments piece that we did, the immune assessments piece that we did the last time. So basically, we've got a core content video. Let's see how long it is. I forget how long it is. It's about 30 minutes long. And I'll just take you through some of the concepts that were here. And so you have an idea of what to really listen for during my 30-minute presentation. This is a very important picture, and we'll show you the full size of it, this fatty acid cascade. But Metametrics and Genova have three different tests, the blood spot, the full blood, the erythrocyte. I've never really chosen to do the erythrocyte, but the blood spot is the one that I do the most. It's the least expensive. It only tests for omega-3s and 6s, the essentials, and then their downstream metabolites. But it gives you a great picture to start. If there's a reason to want to go deeper and see a lot more of those fatty acids, then you have them go to the lab. They have to have their blood drawn to do it, whereas the blood spot, they just prick their finger and send the card in. But it's really when, for me, when I order those would be more like there's a lot of neurologic type symptoms, and I want to look at some of those other things. Yes, Lynn.
Metametrics doesn't exist on its own
anymore. Oh, right? Yeah, it doesn't exist anymore. I mean, these slides do need to be updated, and we're going to go through.
I just want to make sure that I hadn't missed anything.
Yeah, sorry. I forget that. I call them Metametrics and Genova. Yeah, the Metametrics and Genova merged. So any test that Metametrics did, Genova now has. I used to always order the blood spot from Metametrics, and I'm getting used to calling them. It's like when a friend of yours changes their name. Do you ever have that happen? And it's just like, it takes years before you figure it out that, yeah, that they're not the same name and they don't answer to it anymore and whatever. Yeah. Anyway. So here's your inflammatory cascade. And this is basically why people get inflamed, right? This is the mechanism, the chemical mechanism in the body where the inflammation is happening and where the anti-inflammatory comes in. So we did it with little pictures so you get the idea. But and you've seen this before. It's been in the fatty acid modules. It's been in the immune system modules. You'll see it again probably in the detox. And we showed this a lot because it's an important chart. If you have any biochemical pathway you're going to really get to know well, this is a good one. So these two at the top are the essential fatty acids. Linoleic acid, which is omega-6, alpha-linolenic acid is omega-3. And they are converted, they're elongated, they're short chain fats that get elongated to first step EPA or GLA, gamma-linolenic acid and eicosapentaenoic acid. Now, in order for this to go down these pathways, we need to have active functioning of this enzyme delta-6 desaturase. And in a previous, in the immune system assessment piece and in the immune system, the general, you know, information about the immune system, we talked a lot about delta-6 desaturase and all the things that hurt it, all the things that help it. And it's a good thing to remember. Do I memorize them? No, I look at my charts. So I like to print these charts out, have them in my little book by my side, and voila, here's some of the stuff that you need to know more deeply. So let me go back here and just say, we convert to EPA and GLA. We convert the EPA down to PGE, prostaglandin E3, and prostaglandin E1. Those are anti-inflammatory. this should say two. I think that's an error. I think that should say two. These are anti-inflammatory. They convert to, they displace arachidonic acid, which is inflammatory. Okay. So the arachidonic acid comes from membrane phospholipids. In other words, meat, animal products, the lipids that are in the membranes of those cells of those animals get converted into arachidonic acid. Arachidonic acid can be looked at as the bad guy, but a lack of inflammation causes you to die. You need to get inflamed whenever you cut yourself or burn yourself or any kinds of damage like that to linings of the organs and stuff. So arachidonic acid is important, but excess arachidonic acid leads to chronic inflammatory problems like, you know, joint pains, like itises anywhere in the body. So we want to have these firefighters in place, the DGLA and the DGLA and the EPA get converted into these prostaglandins that will basically, they're firefighters, they help to put out the inflammation. They help to decrease the amount of arachidonic acid available to go down these pathways and produce these leukotrienes. Oh, no, there's the two. Sorry, this is correct. This is the one. So these are anti-inflammatory at this level. The arachidonic acid, once the DGLA gets converted into arachidonic acid, it's problematic. So the arachidonic acid goes downstream, and these are enzymes that are used, lipoxygenase and cyclooxygenase, okay? And these are the targets of a lot of anti-inflammatory drugs. A lot of anti-inflammatory drugs target shutting these off. NSAIDs, we'll get it. Where's the other one? Oh, I don't have it here. I should have it here. NSAIDs actually, they disrupt up here in this pathway from linoleic down. So they disrupt the activity of the delta 6 G-saturase, which basically means when somebody's taking non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs for their inflammation, they're not only decreasing the inflammation, they're killing the firefighters. So that works to decrease here and it works to decrease here. So you're killing the firefighters as well. They also decrease down here, all right? So there's a drug modulation picture in module 4 macronutrients under the fats, and you can see what that is. So for us, what we want to be able to do is help people with the nutritional modulation and the balancing of the fatty acids. So these are short chain linoleic and alpha linolenic, and they are not the actively anti-inflammatory that the EPA is. But things like flaxseed, chia seeds, hemp seeds, and all, they're very important to have a person have in their diet to provide this. But in order for the delta 6 G-saturase enzyme to work, to take them and convert them into these potent anti-inflammatories, is we need B vitamins. And what is the average American sorely missing in their diet when they're eating their white bread and their white pasta and their processed and refined foods? B vitamins. Vitamin C, vitamin E, zinc, magnesium, biotin. They take out all those minerals and vitamins from the grains and add back in a couple, like five of them. So most people are deficient here. So it makes it very difficult for them to have an active delta 6 G-saturase. And that's why they say, oh yeah, you can't use vegan sources of omega-3s because people don't convert them. Well, they don't convert them because they're eating crap, not because these are inferior sources, right? They're disrupting them. Plus, trans fats, right? All your processed garbage food that people eat, alcohol, coffee, and food additives also disrupt delta 6 G-saturase. So if you can remember one enzyme in the body that you want to protect to help people with so many problems, delta 6 G-saturase. And there's more details of that in the immune module and in the fatty acid module, okay? So we want to get people down here, but how do we know what the status is of this? How do we know if they're actually doing all of this? Well, that's where testing comes in. So we look at the pictures. Here's some more of it, right? It's optimum ratios of AA, EPA, which can be measured on a fatty acid test. Arachidonic acid, EPA, are between 1.5 and 3. It's considered unwell to have a ratio above 10. And anything above 15 indicates a high degree of inflammation. We see that in people with longstanding depression and bipolar disorder. We see that in people with multiple sclerosis, and other autoimmune conditions. The average American is right there in the unwell range. The average American, AAEPA of 11. And I see this on the tests all the time. And the chronic illnesses are usually above 15. So we're really looking, important marker to be looking for is AAEPA ratio. You can do it on these fatty acid tests, but also most labs can run that. They can run you an AAEPA. So here's, I have it right here too. Delta 60 saturates. These are all the things that inhibit it. These are the things you want to be working with people, which is why we go back to the basics, right? When we're trying to figure out an esoteric, difficult, complex case, we always have to make sure the basics are covered before we try to find the zebras in the haystack, right? Before we try to find some weird thing. But if they get this working properly and you do the test, you go, huh, it's still not working properly. That's when you start to look at more advanced studies. But the basics, so even before you spend their money on a blood spot fatty acid test, not an expensive test as test goes, maybe $150, but work with them here. Get these habits under control. Explain to them this stuff, how it works. When people understand how this stuff works, they're much more likely to be doing the work that it takes. Here's the nutrients to improve delta 60 saturase. So when we're looking at people, we can also look at doing those assessments that we gave you. There's the fatty acid and amino acid one, and then there's the vitamin one and the mineral one. Do those and see symptomatically where they're playing out. Do they have indications of a zinc deficiency or a magnesium or vitamin C or any of the B vitamins? The other thing is, I'm going to explain this because I got confused with my wording last time. I'm going to try to rewrite this a little bit better. But lauric acid comes from coconut. There are studies that show that when you combine lauric acid with your omega-3 short chains, like what's in flax and chia and all that, the alpha-linolenic acid, that delta 6 to saturase enzyme activity improves by tenfold. Tenfold. That's a lot. So the lauric acid allows the buildup of these fats in the tissue, even when the essentials are low. It helps to maintain them. There's the good ratios. And this is at the beginning of our chart. And this is taken from the spreadsheet. And we have a link to the spreadsheet in the module. And
do you get
this? Yeah.
Do you get lauric acid from anywhere other than coconut oil?
Coconut itself, not coconut oil per se, but yeah, I do, not in significant quantities.
Okay, thank you.
It would be good to look up lauric acid to see where it is, but by far coconut has the most, and it actually has more lauric acid than it does some of the other saturated fats that are not as beneficial. Another one that's important there is myristic acid, myristeric, something like that. And that's another one of those fatty acids. They're shorter chain fatty acids, shorter chain saturated fats, as opposed to the longer chain ones. And they tend to have very important antiviral properties and anti-candida properties as well.
And where would you find myristic?
Coconut.
Okay.
Yep. Okay. So that's the first one. And the part two is where we're actually going to get into looking at the tests. There it is. Okay, so part two, I've got a whole bunch, and I go through them step by step in the video, a whole bunch of different cases. It's probably an hour long.
Welcome to part
almost 41 minutes long. All right, so if we look at the slides for this, I'm just going to take you through a few examples. I think I did some of these examples last time. Let me see if I can find one. Okay, so this is a 60-year-old suffering from celiac, undiagnosed for 60 years. And she found out, I have celiac disease, and gave up wheat, and things started changing. And a long-standing history of depression. So we decided to do the blood spot fatty acid test. And you look to see the EPA, this is an older one, so it's not showing. I wonder why it's not showing the alpha linoleic. I guess this old version didn't show it. But her EPA and DHA, you can see, are very, very low. Very, very low. Her linoleic, on the other hand, is really high. So she's probably got a lot of those plant fats that are high in omega-6, you know, sunflower seeds, almonds, things like that. The GLA is actually quite good in the middle, but her DGLA is super high and her arachidonic is reasonable. So when I looked at this, I said, well, we need to get these up. So we can do this in a number of ways. We can either have you eat a lot of chia and flax and all those short chains, omega-3s, and then make sure you take in your B vitamins and doing all that. It might take a little longer, or we can supplement with fish oil, and then you can go to the plant-based for maintenance. So she decided to go with the fish oil, and this was her 4 months later. Oh, and her AAEPA ratio, we talked about that a little while ago. Look at it, 22.3. That's way high, right? If we want to keep it in the below 4 range. Okay, so here she is 3 months later. She does her EPA. She starts taking fish oil, a high EPA fish oil, not a cod liver oil, but more of the, you know, general, I think she took Omega Nutrition, the one that is, it's high in EPA. She took that. She lowered down some of her omega-3 fats. She went lower in her GLA, so we needed to move that up a little bit. But look how much better this whole thing looks. And look at her AAEPA ratio. It's 1.6. That's too low, right? Because if it goes too low, if it goes lower than that, she could get into a bleed out situation because the omega-3s are anticoagulant as well. So I had her decrease her EPA a little bit and increase her GLA. And 9 months later, she was even lower. I guess she didn't do it. This is when they started to show both ways. So it might have been there that we just talked about one or the other. Now I can't remember because it's so long ago. But here she went even further low. So here's like, okay, you did much better in the previous one. She went to a AAEPA of 1.5. Now she's at a 0.8. So what did we do? I had her decrease this just a little bit, decrease her fish oil mainly, and increase her GLA. And then, no, I don't have the next one. Darn it. I thought I had the next one. I thought I had the whole sequence. But what happened was she got into a good range after that, right? But then she had to figure out what was the range she needed to keep. Let me find another one that's a good one. Is this hers? This doesn't look like hers at all. It's very different. Okay, so then we have this. Let's see what this was. Yeah, so here's one that worked out really well. So he was super low, you can see on EPA. He was reasonably up there on the AA, the ALA, but he wasn't converting. Right? He wasn't converting at all. So he had good ALA. So I'm going, okay, delta 60 saturase. What do we have to do to protect delta 60 saturase? What was he doing that was causing, you know, was he drinking alcohol, caffeine, et cetera? So we took away some of those habits, worked on the B vitamins and the C and the magnesium and all that, and talked to him about lowering some of the other plant oils, first of all, take out, and then you know, lowering some of the other plant-based fats that are high in omega-6. And he went from a 34.7, that's really awful. And this was 15 months later, because he didn't, you know, those people who they come back and we don't do that anymore. We have programs, but people used to just come in and go, oh yeah, I think I'll come back. His ALA was still high, but his EPA was high. So we, you know, needed him to get those back down and lower this a little bit. But I didn't want to mess with it too much because look at his ratio, right? His ratio was perfect at 3. And this one doesn't say who it is. I have too many of these here, but I can just look at these and I'm just going to out of the blue, just interpret one and then see if you guys get it. So I'm looking here. What do I notice? First thing, ALA is high. It's high, and then it's not high proportionally to the EPA. The EPA isn't bad. So when I look at this one, let's look at this one. I'm looking at him here, and I'm guessing he's doing a good job of eating walnuts, and he's eating chia seeds, flax seeds, hemp seeds, things that contain ALA, but he's not supplementing at all, right? And he's not converting. In this case, I look and say, this person is really high here, but they're not as high here. So it says there's a conversion problem. They're probably taking an EPA supplement. Do you see where I got that? Now this EPA, they're not a DHA. So it's a EPA supplement without the DHA. Okay. So that's how I got that. When I look here, though, they're eating a lot of plant-based oils. You ask a lot of questions. And sometimes I just interpret these. I don't know anything about people. Somebody will bring it to a call and I'll interpret it. And I go, okay, here's the questions. And yep, sure enough, you're usually right after you've done these enough. Very low in the GLA. GLA is high in borage oil, black currant oil, but also hemp seeds have a decent amount of GLA. So what I would do here, and I look at the ratio, not terrible, 6.3, because the arachidonic is so low. So the arachidonic is low over it because these are low, the GLA is low. And given, it's probably not eating a lot of meat because the arachidonic is low, but on the other hand, doesn't have enough of these precursors, this delta 60 saturase is completely blocked. So we needed to work on that. Is everybody going away? See about a couple of others. Here's one where I'm pretty certain that they're taking EPA because their ALA is lower than their EPA. So probably an issue that they are supplementing. The ratio isn't terrible at 6.6, but I like to see it a little bit lower than that. And lots of these, but the GLA is fine, but the arachidonic is high. So I would probably be asking this person, how much meat do they eat? How much dairy? How many eggs? Because they're the ones that contain it. And the only other plant foods that contain arachidonic acid in significant amounts is peanuts. So I ask them about those foods. And then we tweak their diet, we tweak their supplementation accordingly. Let's see if I have any other before and afters. I think those are the only ones at the beginning. Let's see. I'll do one more and then we'll open to questions. So here the ALA and the EPA are similar, right? So either this is one case of perfect conversion or they're taking a decent amount of EPA and it's just keeping it that way. So that we don't know until we start to ask them, what are you taking? I wouldn't say, oh, I bet you're taking an EPA supplement, aren't you? No, I wouldn't say that. I would just ask, right? If they aren't taking an EPA supplement, then they're doing a great job. If they are taking an EPA supplement, they're probably at a good level. But the problem with this AAEPA ratio is their arachidonic is too high. So we'd want to do things to pull the arachidonic down. Any questions? It takes practice. It takes doing them over and over again. I'll stop the share and you can ask questions. It takes practice and just doing them. But the more you do them and the more you keep in mind that delta 60 saturase chart and how those things are working, the easier it's going to get for you to convert. Any questions? No? Lynn? Yeah.
So one thing that I've been pondering is it the source or how much you're absorbing?
Mm-hmm. That's right. You have to take that in. If they're telling you how much they're taking and they're not absorbing, then you're starting to look at what organs.
Yeah.
What organs?
Because I do know there are some people who actually do better when they're eating the meat. And, you know, it seems to be contrary to what we're taught, but... And so I'm just kind of balancing out that what we're taught with these results that we see. Mm-hmm. And so that's had me thinking about that absorption factor.
Yeah, the absorption factor is always an issue, right? So if somebody tells you what they're eating and they're eating plenty of protein, or you run it through a chronometer, they're eating plenty of protein, but their protein numbers are low, then we're thinking, what's happening to that protein? Where is it going? And those are people who say, oh, I can't do without meat, because they are absorbing only a small percentage of their protein and they need more concentrated sources of it. With the fats, a little bit different. You know, we have to look at what's the gallbladder and the liver function. Is the liver getting fatty because of their high sugar diet? You know, you really have to tease all this out and think about all of this stuff being like pieces of the puzzle. And everybody's puzzle is a little bit different, and we're trying to figure out which are the missing pieces for them. Yep.
If they were, if they looked like they were eating a good amount of protein and yet they were registering low, what would be, say, your first two or three steps that you would try to tease them into doing?
Yeah, that's a good question, because if they have a good immune system, they're not getting sick regularly, they have good strong bones, and you know, they've tested it on a density test or whatever, and they're growing muscles, they look fit and trim, and they don't have any issues, which is rare that we're going to see those people, because they don't show up in our offices, right? They just go about their lives. But if that's all the case, then maybe we just say, well, maybe that range, that number range isn't working, isn't, you know, the ideal for you, right? You know, if it's slightly low, I see people with low white blood cells, and sometimes it's normal, but it's, I'm watching what's happening to those white blood cells over time. If they've always had a 4 on their white blood cell count and they're healthy and everything's good, their immune system's fine, they don't have an autoimmune disease, they're not getting sick all the time, I'm not worried about it. But if that's not the case and they do have an autoimmune disease or some other things are happening in their body, then we want to investigate further.
And how, when you're looking at somebody's numbers and say 10 years ago, they went through cancer treatment, how does that mess everything up? I mean,
it messes things up in ways we don't even know how to describe, right? Because it's, chemotherapy is such an invasive process, right? And then if they did radiation on top of it, and we're basically, how can we kill off the not good cells before the good cells die? And there's going to be fallout and there's going to be death to those good cells, especially with radiation. You know, you can't target it. There are ways to target chemo, and most doctors aren't using them, with insulin potentiated chemotherapy. You shoot somebody up with insulin and all those insulin receptors light up and they grab on to the chemo. They go, ooh, give me that stuff. And the others only get a small little percentage drive-by of it. So there's ways to decrease that. With radiation, you know, there's not a whole lot of ways that you can decrease the fallout from radiation and the damage. And it's those kinds of treatments are so aggressive that it's always, can we kill the cancer before we kill the patient?
Yeah.
Whereas we're working at building them up, so from the inside out, their body is able to, you know, get active and get rid of that stuff. There's no easy answer, right? There's no like, yeah, this is the ideal range, but that might not be the ideal range for everybody, right?
Yeah.
It's closer, but you take into, you're right about taking into all those other things into account and figuring it out.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Good question. All right. Who wants to look at allergy testing? Want to look at allergy testing? Yay. Okay. Not my favorite thing ever.
I just did a food sensitivity test today. And
on yourself?
Well, I did the Viome food sensitivity testing, and so it's a blood spot thing, only I couldn't get enough blood out, and I have a husband who's a nurse, and so in our prepper packages, we've got needles and syringes and stuff, so he poked me and we pulled out some blood to fill up this tube that they sent us. Cause I couldn't.
They sent you a tube to fill up on a blood spot? Usually it's a card.
Yeah. No, I got me a tube. Yeah.
Wow.
So.
Wow. That's a hard one. That's a tough one.
So yeah. Anyway.
Wow. And it was supposed to be done at home. Okay. Well, I'll be curious to see. I'll be curious to see how those
go. So that's why when you were saying you're doing this, I'm like, oh.
Yeah, well, I don't have the Viome in there because that's
a new test. It's just interesting to see what kind of
things. Yeah. So the Viome does it differently. Their food sensitivity is really, not if they're getting it from blood. I know the Viome has a part where they do the stool testing and from your microbiome. You did that part of it too?
I did that too.
Okay. So they're probably going to look at, do you have antibodies, and match up to what the microbiome is saying about what's good for you, which is a new piece of that. I don't think they used to have that. I bought one of those kits.
Actually, so the food sensitive tests, they just discontinued. And so that's why I got it in real quick. But they now have one called the health intelligence, and it does the whole, like you said, the whole genome and the cellular and everything, but it's like $300-$400. Not mm-hmm. doing it anytime soon. But anyway, so when you said you were doing this with this food sensitivity, I was like, yep, I need to listen to this again.
Okay. So let's go there. I have it open here. All right. So your learning objectives, and I'm going to be full transparency. I have never met a food sensitivity test that I'm in love with. I've done hundreds of them, really, and some of them just confuse the heck out of me and the patient, and we don't know what to do with them because it's just so overwhelming. So I want you to understand when they're presenting with symptoms of allergy and testing. And my personal approach to this is somebody comes in, I get them cleaned up first. I get all the major allergens out and I clean up their fatty acid profiles and I do all this stuff before. And if they're still like, I don't know, every now and then I eat something and I get this particular reaction and they're not able to identify it to a particular food, then I might run a test. But if you run a food sensitivity panel on someone who has a leaky gut and an immune system that's fighting against all get out to get rid of stuff that's coming in, like antigens and stuff, you're going to get a lot of positives. And I've done that before where I run the test and this person has 27 foods they're sensitive to, and we get them to actually comply and get off of those 27 foods, and they do it for 3 months. This is in my very early days. And they come back in, and they have 27 different foods, and maybe there's two of them the same. And they're like, what? I realize we have to clean the leaky gut. We can't just go with this, get rid of the foods. It's not the food's fault, it's the body's fault. And sometimes there are like specific allergies that you never get rid of, that they were there since birth. They may have been antibodies that get passed along from mom. They're living in the body and they don't go away. And there's several people that have a few of those. Usually one in a person or two, but not like 27. If it's 27, it's something else. So I want you to understand the different kinds of allergic reactions, the IgGs, the IgE, IgA, and IgM. And some of the labs will just do IgG. Some of them just do IgA. Some of them do the whole panel. And when would you want to? IgG, I think, is kind of a waste to run because IgG is immediate hypersensitivity. Eat strawberries, get hives. Go out and get exposed to freshly mowed grass and get your runny nose and runny eyes. Those are immediate sensitivities. You don't need anybody with a degree to figure that out. You don't need an expensive test to figure it out. So IgEs, I'm kind of like, you probably know your IgEs already. But what about your IgAs, which are delayed sensitivity? IgMs, which are like a recovery stage, and IgA, which is mucous membrane. So which tests are appropriate for your clients? The difference between the inhalant, the contact, the food intolerance. Am I not sharing my screen again?
I was trying to
stop it.
That's what you were saying. I saw you doing something, Liz. Like, what is she doing?
So I'm not seeing you. If you don't see me, if you don't see the screen and I'm sharing, I don't even see you. And that should be a trigger to me to know that. So these are the learning objectives. Learn the difference between the different kinds of allergies that people may have: contact, inhalant, food intolerance, hypersensitivity, and all that. And then understand when to implement an elimination provocation protocol. And then when would you actually do lab testing? So let's go from there.
But all of this is after you would recommend getting that person to do a complete elimination diet.
If you can, right? You can't always do that. So it's when people aren't willing or able to do that. But I would always do this after getting them to clean up their act, because I don't want to take somebody in and say, "Oh, you have problems. Let's do a food sensitivity process," and not clean up their hydrogenated fats, not clean up their white flour that they're eating all the time, right? And here's the thing I found that really frustrated me about a lot of these allergy tests. was that someone would have a known allergy to something. Soybeans, for example. This is my husband. He's so sensitive to soybeans. It's an IgE reaction. His throat closes up. His gut gets inflamed. We run a test. We run an allergy test. It shows up that there's no allergy to soy. Why? It was an IgG test. But the average person doesn't know that. The average practitioner doesn't even know that. They go, oh, you're not allergic to soy. Go ahead and eat it. Then he dies, right? Because he thinks, you know, same thing with gluten, right? The gluten sensitivity. Sometimes like if people have been away from eating it for a while and they go and do the test and it comes back that they're not allergic, they go start eating it again because they think they're safe. So it gives people a false sense of safety. When in reality, if you look at like Cyrex Labs has a array five is, or six is a food sensitivity or 10 or one of their arrays is a food sensitivity. And what they tell you is before you do this test, go back and eat all the foods you've been avoiding. I'm not going to tell that to somebody who's been eating gluten for years and now feels better. They may want to hear that, but they're not going to like me after a month of doing that just so we can get a test. It's enough for me to know. I eat gluten, I get these symptoms. I stay away from gluten, the symptom goes away and I feel better. I don't need to test it. I don't need confirmation. Some people need the confirmation. Some people need it because they need to know it. And if that's the case, they probably haven't given it up in the first place, right? Because they don't believe you and they want to see it. So it's easy to test them. I had one patient one time, very sweet woman in around, you know, the perimenopausal age. So she might've been in her like early late 40s, early 50s. And gluten, yeah, I think gluten's a problem and da, 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 but I don't pay attention when I go out. I just pay attention when I'm home. I said, really, you should. And she had some menopausal symptoms that we're trying to work on and looking at other things. And I said to her, how about if you get tested? If you get tested and it shows that you're sensitive to it, will you be ultra careful? She said, yeah. So she, not only she decided to do the food, the allergy testing with the IgA in the gut, because if people are not eating it regularly, usually you'll still see the IgA antibodies because they're like the soldiers just waiting, right? Just waiting. If you do it in the blood, they're like, they're gone. We don't need those antibodies anymore. Let's just pull them out when we get exposed again. But the IgAs are like, we're protecting you, baby. We're going to protect this lining. You can get a good a test that way, even if they've been off of it for a while. So she went, she got the test done, and this company also had some of the genetics. This is before 23andMe got popular, but they had like three or four different genetic markers for celiac and gluten sensitivity. She tests herself, comes back positive, high levels of the antibodies and the genetics. She swears off gluten forever. Her symptoms get better. But not only that, she goes and she says, well, if I have these and I have the genetics, let's test the family. She tests the family, all her kids, and she became like the gluten-free Nazi at home, right? And they're like, nope, not a-. All her kids' symptoms got better. So she was a health coach and she decided that was what going to be her new specialty. She was just going to work with people on gluten intolerance and getting rid of the gluten in their diet. Made a huge difference. And she wasn't eating it a lot. She was only eating it like once every week or two when she went out to dinner, but it was enough to not get rid of the long-term problem. So she needed that. I tried convincing her. I've never had my gluten tested. I just know I'm super sensitive to it. I have some genes for it. And whenever I eat it, I feel good, really bad when I've been, you know, exposed accidentally. And it's been maybe twice over the last 10 years or 6 years. But it made a huge difference. And these were blind exposures. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to try this and I'll be fine. I was eating a salad at a restaurant and I ate the salad. It was a great salad. And I started getting like, oh, weird and tired. And we had to go to the bathroom. And I went back to the restaurant a few days later and I said, tell me what's in this salad. Because I thought maybe it was just I was tired. I had leftovers. Next day, I started eating it again. Oh, same thing happens again. Something's in that salad. I bet there's some gluten in there. So I went to the restaurant and they told me, yeah, it was tamari in the salad dressing. So when you think about how little gluten I got, there's gluten in the tamari. The tamari's in the tahini dressing. The tahini dressing is smothered over this huge salad. How much gluten did I really get? that caused that kind of a reaction. It was very little, but it was enough. And I didn't know that it was there and then like fabricate, you know what I mean? It wasn't that it was like the placebo, the anti-placebo effect. It was, I didn't know. And another thing happened a few years later that I do these monthly potlucks. And after the potluck, I went to, I'm like, I'm so tired. I got to go to bed. And I never go to bed early after those things. I was telling people they needed to go home because I was tired. I was up 3 or 4 times that night with diarrhea. And the next day I couldn't get out of bed. I was so exhausted. And I turned, I had a friend who's very gluten sensitive call me and said, did you get gluten last night? I got gluten last night. I'm like, oh, is that what it was? He said, yeah, we did some calls around and found out that somebody had some non-gluten-free tamari in their salad dressing. Right? So it's really important that people know that just a little bit can cause a problem. Not for everybody, but just a little bit can cause a problem. And so go by the symptoms primarily, and then use the lab testing as a either get them to comply or to verify or to figure out something that you just can't figure out. Now the get them to comply piece, if you do the wrong test, if I were to do an IgE test on her or an IgG test on her, she probably wouldn't have seen it because she'd been mostly away from it. And then she'd go, oh, great, we did the testing and I'm fine. And she'd continue to have all these problems year after year and not know what it was. So it's really important that you get the right test. Okay. All right. So pretest, there's just a few. Here we go. Oh, there's 10 questions, right? So you get to understand, and when you read the pretest and do it, I don't care if you fail. I'm not looking at these, right? This is for you to know, oh, wow, I thought I knew a lot about this, but I don't. And then you go back and you do the content. One thing I forgot to do on the other one, I'll go back and see if we had any advanced resources and what the done for yous were. Some of your modules have assignments, not everyone. We would drive you crazy if we had an assignment at every module, and us crazy marking them. So this one is, see how long this one is.
Hello.
This is over an hour. So this is a hefty presentation. Okay, there's just one, I guess we didn't split it. We oftentimes will go back and split them into shorter ones so it's easier, but sometimes there's just no logical place to make the break and so we don't split them. So the different types of allergies, we review all of those. It's really important that you understand that. It's important that you understand the different antibodies that go for the different stuff, the early in an allergic response, delayed, immediate, and it's a histamine relation. So it's that immediate hypersensitivity, and this is lining the mucous membranes, the IgA. And the symptoms are not just, they're not just the runny noses, and they're not just diarrhea. They can be anywhere throughout the body. So food allergies are really important to address. But if you can start with just a few questions and do a gluten, dairy, corn, soy, eggs, and peanuts, and then, do you ever get this? Do you ever get that? And then you have a few others. You know, you can start with an elimination diet that just eliminates those things. You don't have to have the full blown elimination diet, like the rare foods diet is one of the things I like to do, is just what do you almost never eat because unlikely those are contributing to your symptoms. And you do a rare foods diet and then you're slowly introducing things. But if it's just like 8 foods that you're saying, okay, let's start there. And oftentimes they just feel so much better when they do that. And if not, you either didn't do it long enough or there's other allergens that you need to be removing or there's other stuff going on, you know, neurotransmitter imbalances or stuff like that. This is my standard immune system job, what the, you know, the immune system protects from, the different components and the leukocytes. This is a little bit more detailed than I do for my public presentations. But the thing about it is when you do the white blood cell count, always have them do differentials, always. Some of the labs don't, which is crazy. What they basically do is just measure the white blood cells. We want to know what percentage of those are neutrophils, what percentage are eosinophils, basophils, monocytes, lymphocytes, and plasma cells. We want to know the percentage of those. Some of the labs will give you the differential, but they don't actually calculate you the percent. those labs get me angry. Let me just say, because the computer can easily say, oh, the total white blood cell count is 10,000 and you've got 7,500 basophils. Now, well, you wouldn't have that. Let's say 7,500 neutrophils, right? If it's that easy, I can do the math, but it's usually not that. It's like these weird numbers. And in my head, I'm trying to calculate what percentage it is. Why waste a clinician's time figuring that out when the computer can spit it? So neutrophils, 40 to 60%. You're going to see these up, and it could be a bacterial infection. If you see these elevated for longer, like say you have low white blood cells, and the percentage is off, then it's usually some sort of chronic bacterial infection that's living there. But eosinophils are the important ones when it's related to allergies. They will be elevated. They're related to allergies and parasites even. So they should be closer to zero. If they go above 3, then we know that there's some sort of allergic response. And that's when we know we really want to start looking for this. But that's, again, these are not delayed hypersensitivity allergies. These are usually those quick reaction ones. Basophils related to histamines and allergy, but also, they can also be related to parasites. So between these two, you get an indication, is it parasites or allergy? Because eosinophils are always elevated in allergies as far as I have seen. Monocytes, the second line of defense, elevated in the recovery stage, should be 0 to 7%. If you see monocytes elevated, the first thing you want to ask is, are you just recovering from a cold or a flu? And if they say, oh yeah, I had whatever last week, oh, that's why their monocytes are elevated. But if they say no, then what I suspect is some sort of chronic infection somewhere or an autoimmune condition. They're often elevated there. And then lymphocytes, these guys make antibodies. They're usually related to the viral infection, 20 to 40%. And then I tell you where they're formed and you can listen to my whole presentation on it. The plasma cells are made from the B cells. Remember, the B cells are the memory cells. So the pathogen comes in, it's flagged by a macrophage, I gotcha. It's handed off to an antigen presenting cell. The antigen presenting cell calls in the T cells to kill it and get rid of it, and then triggers the B cells to make antibodies so that the next time the response happens more quickly. So the plasma cells are the ones that are made from the B cells to actually, you know, continue the process and be available. Talk about antibodies, the IgMs and Ds and Gs and As and Es. You can listen and read about those. I think you guys know that, but the main thing is this IgA lines the mucous membranes. And if it's off, the lungs, the respiratory tract in the nose, the throat, the vaginal tract, the gut, all of those things are lined with mucous membranes and have the IgAs associated with them. There's what I just said in a nutshell, right? Invader makes its way in, the macrophages engulf it, they give it to the antigen presenting cells who grab, you need vitamin D, so this gives you more details. Why is vitamin D important in infection? Well, the vitamin D receptors go and find the T cells to mobilize and start to bring the natural killer cells, the cytotoxic cells, swarm in and destroy the invader. The Tregs are important, and sometimes people don't have enough T regulatories, and they can cause this imbalance between T helper and T suppressor. And the suppressors are going to suppress the immune response. The helpers are going to help activate it. In a hypoimmune situation where the person's underreacting, prone to a lot of infectious disease, there might be an imbalance between T suppressors and T helpers and that the suppressors are higher. But in an autoimmune or allergy situation where there's more activity happening, the T helpers may be higher than the suppressors and it gets out of hand. We have T helper type ones and twos and all that. So is that clear to everybody? Because if it's not, it's really hard to understand how any of this works. Yes? And then you can look at it in action and you can see the different steps and what's involved with each step. And I describe it in the video. So what are some of the lab tests for food reactions? So we have skin pricks, right? Oh, look at Johnny's allergic to peanuts. Well, didn't you know that? Because every time Johnny eats peanuts, he can't breathe anymore. Why did we need to prick poor Johnny's hand and arm and make them red? We knew that, right? They're kind of useless, in my opinion. Usually people know, right? It might be in a kid where they don't know if there's a lot of allergens like that, but those are easy to detect with the food allergy testing, the elimination diet. So here's some of the tests that I've used over the years. The ALCAT test, there's blood, and they do a different mechanism. They look at the white blood cell activity. The blood antibody tests, usually those are looking at IgGs, but there are some labs that will do an IgG, IgA, and IgM, or they'll do whichever one you choose. The stool antibody tests, which quite frankly, if I had to pick, they're the only ones that I trust. They're the only ones I've seen consistent results with because they're measuring the IgAs. There's not a lot of them available. Like with the blood antibodies, the IgG tests, you can get like a panel of 100 tests for $100, right? Some of the labs do. But with the stool antibody tests, it's a smaller panel and it's more expensive than that. And then saliva. And I think with the saliva, you do have to be careful, right? It's mucous membrane. Are they testing IgAs in your saliva? Probably not likely to be there. I mean, probably likely to be there. Testing IgGs in your saliva? Probably not likely to be there, right? Because those are more in the blood and they're 2 or 3 days out before they are produced. So it's, what are they testing? Be really astute when somebody comes out with this new test. A hair test for food allergies? If somebody's doing a hair test for food allergies, nobody's been able to explain me the mechanism of why and how that works. If I can see a mechanism as to why a hair test works for food allergy detection, but they say, oh, it's cheap and it's easy. Yeah, but is it work? Is it just a bunch of confusing information? I don't know. So the gluten stool test, Entero Labs also now tests for dairy and corn and a whole bunch of the common ones. I think they do about 20 different stool tests for that. Cross-reactivity. So again, these are IgGs and A's, so they can be a little bit more effective. They're testing the blood. And so there's, somebody goes off of gluten, like about 30% of people who are truly sensitive to gluten go off of it and don't see much of a difference. It's because there's other things that are cross-reacting. And sometimes they even do more of those things. Like if it's quinoa, oh, I'll just have quinoa and rice bread because I'm not having bread anymore. And they're actually increasing the amount of those. So there's a cross-reactivity list. It's, I'll show you where it is on the site. I gave you the list straight from their test. Some people choose to do the test, which is I think $225 or something like that. Or you just give them the list and say, just avoid these things for some length of time and then we'll add them back one at a time. And I actually had someone who reversed her lupus antibodies in 3 months by doing that. She had been off of gluten for a long time. She was a cancer survivor. And she, for whatever reason, I don't know why they did these lupus antibodies, and they were astronomical, like 3,000. They said, well, you have lupus. She goes, I don't buy that. She realized that she thought, I talked to her about it and I asked her some stuff and I said, it's gluten cross-reactivity, because she had told me that she had a friend who just opened a gluten-free bakery and she was patronizing the gluten-free bakery for her friend and eating all these grain, non-gluten grain related products that she generally didn't eat. So I told her about this test. I gave her, so she said, just give me the list. I'm just going to avoid those things. She avoided them. 3 months later, she went back to the doctor. She felt so much better. She went back to the doctor and said, can you run the lupus test again? He goes, oh, I'm sorry, dear. We don't do that. Once the levels are that high, they never go down. She insisted. They got them done. Right. Exactly. Got them done. It was below 100. 3 months. Right. So this stuff works. It's just a matter of identifying the right people to get the right tests. And then that gluten detail test, and now I've got to update this too. Vibrant America has their gluten zoomer, which tests for like 20 different types of antigens related to gluten. And then they test all kinds of cross-reacts as well. That's a much more detailed one. But the gluten detail test from Cyrex is pretty good as well. It's just not as complete as the one from Vibrant America. If you want to write that down, the gluten zoomer, you probably heard of it before. So those are the tests. There's I've had mixed responses, and then here's a little bit more detail about them. There's the ALCAT, what it does. It's looking at the leukocytes. It's actually looking there. But the thing about it is, the way they tell you to do it, you can test up to 350 foods, chemicals, herbs. They have different panels. And I get the report back from somebody who has like a whole bunch in the borderline, a lot in the borderline, less, but still a lot, like maybe a dozen in the yellow, which is, you know, the medium, and then the severe, where they may have had a half a dozen to 8 or 10. And they're like, oh God, what do I eat? So we cleaned up her diet. We got her to do all that. And they said that you should have them go back on the foods before retesting. That was it. So I said, let me get this straight, right? We took her off these foods. We told her to stay away from the borderlines for a month, the middle ones for 3 months, and the other ones for 6 months. Now we want to go back and test. And you want her to go back on those foods? She's feeling way better. Let's just retest. They said, basically, you're not going to get a good test because she's not eating the foods. Back to that again, right? So I got discouraged with it. Lots and lots of controversy and skepticism about it. And even just testing somebody 2 or 3 days in a row, do you get the same tests? And you don't. You don't. So I just don't like them very much. But this is what they look like, the different panels that they have. This is what the report looks like. And then you're trying to figure out what they can eat here. This is an actual person who I blanked out the name, but that's the one I was just saying. There's a whole bunch of them in the milds, a whole bunch of them in the moderates, and there are even more in the severe. And it was challenging with basil and caraway and cauliflower and, you know, a lot of the foods she'd been eating a lot of. So we did it a couple of times and we got discouraged, and now she's doing really well now, but the elimination diet was the way to go. All right. So, I talked about that before. There's a Genova, and they basically are all pretty similar, modeled non-allergic, mild, moderate, severe, and they'll tell you, but this is an IgG. So I take it with a grain of salt. This is the, this is the one from Genova. I did this one back when they were still Genova Metametrics. So I'll stick with that. But this one's an easy one. If somebody comes out here, they've probably done a bunch of work. This was a sample, so I don't know this person, but they've probably done a lot of work on their leaky gut and on their overall health before doing the food allergy testing. The food allergy testing shouldn't be the thing to do at first. Elimination diet, sure. But to do the food allergy testing, when you get somebody come in off the street and they're just eating crappy food and not exercising and doing all this stuff, you're going to get a lot show up. This is an easy one. Okay, let's just take her off the egg white and take her off for 6 months, see what happens. Take her off the milk and peanuts. Guess what? She would have been off those three anyway if she just followed my food elimination thing, right? Saved some money. And then it was just strawberry. Chances are good that the strawberry she knew already, because most people who have an allergy to strawberries know it. But this is an easy test. You know, we keep her off the milds for a month or so and then add them back in, right? See how she feels. See how she feels without them and put them back in. These we wait. And these may be permanent.
And she could have been, should have been responding to those milds potentially because she was doing the moderates and severe. And if she has time yes. to go from moderates and severe, she might be okay with the milds, right?
Yeah, occasionally, like every 4 days or so.
Okay.
Right. Even if the antibodies don't go away, she'll probably tolerate them. But as soon as you start doing it more regularly, then the problems amplify. Okay. Yeah. And there's their tree allergies and stuff like that. And Terra Lab. Okay, case one. I think that if you listen, you're going to hear about the case one. And case two is from immune testing module. Okay. Oh, case one from immune testing module was the stool allergy. So if you go to the immune testing and watch that case, you'll see it. And the stool testing, this is just from them. They have various ones, but it's expensive. It's $5.39 to do it in the stool. And it's not a lot. It's not a lot. They do some of the white nightshades as well, some of the common nuts, but they're effective, but they're expensive. And a lot of people, if I'm going to have them spend that kind of money on testing, why can't I prefer to do elimination diets when I can. You know, obviously there's times when you can. An autistic kid, right? Get the autistic kid to actually follow that, right? It's hard. So you figure out some of the stuff is at least a starting point. You get them off of some of that. They can get some good results. I'm not saying none of the results are valid, because if somebody has these severe reactions and you take them away, they're going to feel better. But is that the whole picture? And that's my concern. Right? Yeah. So diagnostics used to have this. I don't know if they do, but it's just the four most common tests, and they did it in saliva. Yeah, so the Array 3 from Cyrex is a blood test, so it's not something easily that they could do at home. Like Lynn said, she just poked her finger, put it, well, she had trouble with it, but yeah, but that's the way it goes. But they measure IgG and A, whereas a lot of the inexpensive ones are just G. They're just G, so you're not going to see any of the mucous membrane ones. And they also tell you, if they're not eating it, they're not eating gluten, this isn't going to come out. You're not going to see a result that gets you, is what you want. This is what it looks like. So they test the wheat IgG, the wheat IgA, wheat germ agglutinin G and A. Then they test deaminated alpha-gliadin, a specific segment of that protein. And they do that, a couple of those, and then they have all these other different chains and different lengths that they're testing for. So it's a very comprehensive test. A lot of the tests will just test anti-gliadin antibodies, right? So when you look at an antigen-antibody reaction, so you have the antigen, and I'm just going to go big, but they're microscopic, obviously, but they still are, they're chemically complicated, these proteins, and they're looking at different parts of it are going to be reactive. So I'm going to give you an example from right now, the COVID testing. They're saying the antibody testing is only about, you know, 25% false positives or negative, but they're only doing a G and they're only doing one fragment. So say the virus is this long and they just test this piece. But what if your body has developed an antibody to this piece? It's not going to show. It's not going to show that you were exposed. So that's what I like about the Vibrant America test. They just sent me a bunch of test kits. It's hard to get enough blood. I got to do it again. I did it on my son yesterday. It worked. I did it on me the day before, and I have to do mine again because I messed up my card. It was hard for me to hold my finger and pump it and get enough blood in the circle, but we'll try it again. But that one is they test 4 antigens, 3 antibodies. Well, I think the blood spot only tests 2, the M and the G, but if you do the full blood one, they also test the A. I figured we didn't need the A, so we're going to test it and I'll let you know how that goes. The cross-reactivity, right? I talked about this already, right? And so 80% of people sensitive to gluten are sensitive to casein, studies after study after study. And you see people who are sitting around, they get rid of their gluten and they're having their butter and they're having their milk on their gluten-free bread. Dumb work. 80%. That's huge. Similar with oats. People say, well, there's gluten in oats. Not necessarily. It's usually that they're cross-contaminated. What the problem is that the protein, the main protein in oat, is also known to cross-react with gluten. And that's why a lot of people have reactions that way. There's the Array 4, the cross-reactivity. So you have this list. And if you have somebody you suspect, just have them eliminate these for a month and see. So this is, this person didn't show up except for coffee, yeast, and sesame. Okay, so you look at it. Equivocal, I consider net positive. If it's they're not sure, then there's some kind of immune reaction going on. Oh, and this is from there. They have really nice handbooks, by the way, if you do any of the Cyrex lab tests, the interpretation guides. So they basically tell you, you know, how to interpret this. This is a true cross-reactives, right? Some of them are just the same thing, right? In vitro cross-reactive to gliadin. And then they test also for the foods that people are newly introducing. So they may not really be cross-reacting to sesame, hemp, et cetera, but they're testing it because people usually increase the amount of that in the non-gluten products. And so we want to make sure. And then these tend to be over-consumed on a gluten-free diet. And then dairy is a true cross-reactivity. dairy's true cross-reactivity, as is yeast in coffee, believe it or not. Although some people think that the coffee is because it's cross-contaminated. That's a close-up of that. Don't know what this is. Yeah, I'm not really sure what the, I don't think I've used this. So I just put it in there for an example. But what do you do for an elimination diet? You have to eliminate the suspects for at least 4 days. Fasting is the best way because it eliminates everything for 4 days. You can also do like medical food, like something like an ultra clear, ultra sustained, something like that. But you run the risk of they may be sensitive to something in there. And then the rare foods diet. So I have a assessment that you guys have in the assessments module. And what's in there is the a list that they go through and they go, how often do you eat these foods? You know, more than once a week, more than once a month, several times a year, less than once a year. And they're going through that and just answering it. And then you have them go through and pick out all the things that they rarely eat. And then that's what their diet becomes on the rare foods diet. So it's unlikely that they're going to have symptoms because they only eat it once every 2 or 3 years and their symptoms are coming up every 2 or 3 days or every day. You have them introduce one new food at a time. I follow the 3-day rule. If they introduce a food and they get no symptoms, you introduce it again the next day and then the next day. And if after 3 days there's no symptoms, then great, they're off. Sometimes to speed the process up, because this could take a long time, is I will have them do a food group. So I'll say, okay, introduce the brassicas today, right? And then they eat from the brassica family. And if they get a reaction, then good. Then they have to go through the one at a time to see which one it is or to see if it's the whole family or something in there. If not, that they're good, then they've been able to introduce a whole bunch of foods back. I usually try to get them to be introducing as many foods as possible at the beginning so that they have something that they can, you know, sink their teeth into at meals and they know what to eat. I have a program called FAST. We've moved a lot of that into what's really just called the food intolerance. I'm going to check. So that has all the guidelines. So if you go into the food intolerance module on the Unstoppable Health, you're going to see that there.
Is a 4-day elimination on gluten sufficient for a...
No. Not for gluten. And yeah, reintroducing it after 4 days is useless. 6 months at least for gluten. And I'll say that at least 4 days, but for the top allergens, I want to usually get at least a month. And for gluten, okay, six, and dairy sometimes longer too, depending on what kind of symptoms they have. And after a while, when you're working with people on it, you come up with the time and you go, oh yeah, I think we'll do it for this length of time. You just start to get it, you know, in working with them. And it's also how long are they willing to do it? You may not get the best results, but if they're not willing to do it at all, then you're stuck with trying the tests and hoping that the tests show up what you know that they're sensitive to.
Yeah.
There's a muscle testing as well that can be used. You have to go with somebody who really knows what they're doing. It's not just trying to muscle test and sell you a bunch of supplements to counteract it. I don't know about the Nambutripod, I think, and I forget the short name for it, but they basically are testing foods with vials and then they're tapping certain meridian points and you stay away from the foods for 48 hours and then you can go back to them. You know, I know people who've said that worked for them. I know people who've said they've done it and spent a ton of money and it didn't work for them. So, you know, there's all kinds of ways to test it. I used to do a lot of kinesiology testing, so I have all of my vials. And I didn't want my conscious to make me test differently, right? So to influence. So what I would do is I put numbers on all my bottles. And so I would just pull out the bottles and test people, put aside the ones that they tested for, and then look at my list and go, oh, 1, 2, you know, I had like a checklist I could give them. And whenever stuff came up that I wasn't expecting, I kind of felt like I was really being neutral, But it's hard because if you just think that gluten is the biggest thing for these guys to get off of, or dairy, you know, and you're doing muscle testing, it's easy to, bah, you know, unless they're a big, you know, strong person, you could easily overpower them by just by pressing harder. So you really, it's tuning into the energetics of the situation. It's really just about light touch and getting an energetic feel if you do muscle testing. It's at least as effective as most of these lab tests are. And then when we're reintroducing, I always have people do the safe, the suspicious, and problematic. So if they've tested the food, they feel great, they've done it for 3 days, great, it goes on here. If they're not sure, because anything could have happened, right? Not a good night's sleep or a stressful situation that disrupted them, I put it here, and they know it's problematic. They don't have to test it every day for 3 days. If they eat it and they feel like garbage, they just put it in the problematic. They want to do that. They say, do I really have to test this for 3 days? I'm like, no, don't test it for 3 days, right? But if they don't know or they're not sure, you can just continue to test it. And that's it for allergy testing. How's that? Is that helpful? Oh, there's Jill. Hi, Jill and Patty. Any Dr. questions?
Marie?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about the Zoomers? I think that...
The Zoomers, I think they're a little bit better than your average test because they're testing multiple antibodies and multiple antigens.
What are costs?
The costs are high. Yeah. The costs, I don't know how much they are, but they're a few hundred dollars. I would stay away from the ones that are test for 250 antigens for $100. It's probably not all that good. Right? It's just IgG and you may be getting. Not to say these tests are worthless, but I just think that you can't use them in lieu of good clinical judgment and a good process for helping people to clean up their act. Because if somebody's got food allergens, if they have one or two, it could be a genetic thing, right? If they have a slew of them, it's most likely their leaky gut and they need to clean that up. Leaky gut, inflammatory process with fatty acids out of balance.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Anybody else? Questions? Comments?
I'm trying to help. My brother had cancer 10 years ago and he's had all kinds of problems. You know, I mean, he had a chemo cocktail and everything. So we've been talking to him about problems that we kind of suspected he was having before, but he is very anti anything other than a doctor telling him. And so I think he went to one doctor. He's North Austin area. And I think one of the doctors that he went to happened to be tripping out the door and accidentally slammed his face into the concrete and said, oh, you must be gluten intolerant. Just like very accidentally. And so it doesn't sound like, I don't know, maybe they dreamed it or something. Not like really anything was going
on. Sounds kind of weird. And it doesn't sound like something that would engender like trust and confidence.
Right.
But he had the MD on his wall, but he said some wacky things.
There you go. And so Wayne's kind of listening to it, but then he's asking us questions and we're trying to tippy toe and get him to maybe consider things, but he's probably not going to listen anyway.
Yeah. If he's not, if he's poor, then I can't make this recommendation, but if he's willing to spend some money to go to a good holistic doctor, Ann Shippey's in Austin, and she's very good. She has a waiting list. It's $500 it's probably more than that by now for her first appointment. She runs a lot of tests, so you have to be willing to spend money for the testing. And she's good at looking at other things too, like mold, environmental toxins, etc.
Yeah. Okay, I'll try that. Yeah, because I don't think he's going to listen to us. Because he hasn't before, so, but right now he's asking us about dairy, you know, which is great.
Yeah.
So we're kind of holding our breath and trying to figure out how to respond to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That he'll listen, but it's just kind of interesting how you have so many people around you that need help, but they only want to listen if you're going to tell them what they want to hear. So it's just frustrating, you know, and of course I love him. So
of course it's your brother. It's hard to It's hard to take the stand of, you know, if I've got somebody and I'm like, here's how I can help you. And they go, well, don't you just have an herb I can take instead? I'll say, you know, that's not what I do, but thank you very much. Have a good life. Yeah. I'm not going to work with them. I'm going to put myself through that because it's like beating your head against a wall. And they're just going to find a reason why you're just another one in the string of doctors and or practitioners who couldn't help them.
Yeah.
And that's
a little afraid that that's where, I mean, that's usually pretty much where it is anyway. And I think when we were talking about, when we talked about dairy a couple of days ago, the immediate response was, well, I want to look at the research first. It's like,
yeah, it's tons of it there.
There's tons. Go look.
There's tons of it.
I'm not going to do all the work for you, but
No, that's very true. And sometimes what I'll say, look, how can it hurt? Let's just try this elimination diet. These are the top things I think you may have a problem with. Let's just do it for 3 weeks. It's amazing. You know, we take hundreds of people through programs and it's amazing how quickly they get response when they do that. Now, there's oftentimes some other really things that we have to look deeper with, but it's just amazing how many people get a response. And are you willing? Do you want to get cancer again? Do you want to live like this? Or like for me, I'm like, let me stand over me and twirl batons and, you know, chant ancient Indian praises. And if that's going to work to fix me, I'm happy.
I don't care what you're doing if it's going to fix me.
It's going to help. Right? What does it take? Is there some psychic energy that's taken over my heart and now you're going to pull it out and now I'm going to be fine? I'm okay. Give it a try. I am very scientific oriented. I'm not that way about like let's do a hair test for allergies. Prove to me that it works, right? That's different than some ancient entity that took over my soul. I'm more likely to believe that an ancient entity took over my soul than I am to believe that measuring a body part that doesn't have anything to do with that. And if they could show me, I'm happy for it, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of things out there like that. And there's a lot of really be careful with this. People are going to see, I see it on Facebook all the time, the genetic testing where they tell you exactly what you should be eating. And then they have this beautiful report of all the supplements you need. And guess what? If you just click here, you can buy the kit.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of stuff that I think preys on people. And that's also what makes people skeptical about what we do, which is real.
Yeah. It's heartbreaking. I don't see how do you get to a place where you're okay with that? Where you don't take it to bed and stew on it, you know, or.
I talk to the people that I want to have listen to me. I talk in such a way that I attract the people that I want. Do all of them? No. I mean, no, believe me, we get plenty of people on our calls asking the wackiest question. Like yesterday on the call, what do you do for people that have corn allergies? I'm like, oh, we tell them to stop eating corn. Like, right? And then another one, do you eat solid foods when you're doing a fast? Like, no, we don't eat anything. We just drink water when we're on a fast. So these people have a lot of misconceptions and they don't understand. But a lot of them, I find that when I actually sit and talk to them, they're open. Like a lot of folks are really open. Lynn was just telling me about her 89-year-old that came through and she's coaching. And she's like, oh yeah, she's ready to do whatever it takes to make changes. Right? 89. That's cool. People get pretty set in their ways.
Oh, I was showing a picture of her to my husband. I said, guess how old she is. He goes, 68, 69. I said, she's 89. He was like, what? And it goes, I mean, her brain is sharp, just sharp. And I'm really, really happy about that.
Yeah. And there's people like that. And I love working with them. One of the people in we have a 4-month program where I'm actually doing a little bit of, and I got to get off in 2 minutes, a little bit of private coaching. And I said to her, so what's your goal? She goes, well, I'm going to be 80 soon. And my goal is to be living to 100, free of medication and full of energy. And I'm like, great. Let's work on you. Let's get working. Super. Right. So I've got to go. Got another call.
I have a really quick question, I think. Because I was reading up on ammonia. And when I was looking at the one thing that you had there about the...
that ammonia test scripts. I can't find any either, any ammonia.
When you were looking at one of the slides there, it was talking about the transglutaminase. And one of the things that I was reading about with the ammonia is that this transaminate glutamate, which is, or any other amino acid, when you add an alpha keto acid to it, you get it, there's this change that happens. And so I was wondering, the reason I asked this is because if they have that showing up on that allergy test, is that something to be aware of in their eating and they're producing more ammonia?
Well, it could be. I mean, it certainly can be. I mean, if it shows up there, then I'm going to get them off of the gluten, right? Which is the transglutaminase is part of the gluten. So it's a good point. And I really want to research more. I mean, the pathway of producing ammonia and see, but there, I couldn't find I wanted somebody to test.
Yeah, no, the only thing I could find was the blood test. And then there is one of those kind of tests you were just talking about, because you also get ammonia in your bones and your brain and all these mm-hmm. other things. And so they have it's like DHT or DRT or something where you hold those like around your brain and your mouth and
area. Oh, an energetic testing. Yeah.
To see if it's there.
To see if it's there. Yeah. Cause ammonia then, you know, it's produced in the cycle, the glutathione cycle and BH4 and all, and it can create some serious brain fog problems, which is what this person was experiencing.
Right. So.
Anyway. I'm going to run. Thank you so much, guys. Have a great rest of the day, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.